This is Radio Influence. Podcasting redefined. You are sitting ringside with David Penzer on Radio Influence.
Welcome to Sitting Ringside. My name is David Penzer, and welcome to week two of Sitting Ringside with me. And appreciate the feedback I got from the fans that took a listen. Be sure, if you haven't listened to my almost 90-minute interview with Justin Roberts, be sure to take a listen to that. And I appreciate the feedback. Please send any and all feedback to either at David Penzer on Twitter or at Penzer Ringside at Twitter, or preferably both. But positive, negative, good, bad, let me know. I appreciate those who listened, and we hope you'll enjoy week two and many, many beyond. Don't want to be a somber SOB. I apologize in advance, but I guess this is my podcast, so I guess I could do whatever makes me feel good. And I wanted to take a few minutes to talk about a friend of the wrestling business that was lost this week. And, you know, I worked in a business and continue to work in a business where we lose so many of our friends over the years, less now than back in the day when a lot of them were dying way too soon. You know, off the top of my head, Eddie Guerrero, Kurt Hennig, Johnny Grunge, Rocco Rock, you know, so many. That's just, you know, Brian Adams, so many that were lost. Young, Big Boss Man, Ray Traylor, Rick Rude. You know, you sort of learn to be numb to it a little bit. But this one hit me pretty bad. And it's not a name that a lot of you guys are going to know. It's not a name who people are going to recognize for the most part. His name was John Johnson. He went by Double J, almost as a tribute to Jeff, not a copy. And I knew him as Jackie. That's what they called him back in the day. His father owned a newsstand in Miami, Florida. It was a very popular newsstand. And a lot of the wrestlers would go in, read the wrestling magazines. You know, a lot of times they'd send their mail from there. And so Jackie at a young age became a wrestling fan. He just was like always around. My whole life for 25 years in the business, he kind of just was like always around. But he got to know a lot of the guys, as the years went by. I'd venture to say that Jackie had more friends in the professional wrestling business the day he died than I've had in my entire life, all put together in 51 plus years. Fun guy, loved professional wrestling, loved the business. Would give you the shirt. You know, the saying the guy would give you the shirt off his back is almost too common these days. There's really not a lot of people that give you the shirt off my back. There's about 10 people who I'd give the shirt off my back to, if I'm being honest. You know, if you take that literally. But I wouldn't give the shirt off my back to thousands of people, but he would, no matter how close he was with you, no matter when was the last time you spoke to him? If you were ever his friend, he ended every conversation by saying, "I love you, man." And, you know, that's something that doesn't happen enough in the wrestling business and in the world, quite frankly. And, back in the Monday Night Wars, he became one of the first guys to kind of hang out at the hotels and the airports and the arenas and have the boys sign stuff. And the boys knew he was going to put it on eBay. That was his job. They'd sign photos, they'd sign dolls, they'd sign, you know, whatever Jackie could find that he thought could make money on eBay. Because he was such a nice guy, and because he was, you know, his love for the business and his respect for the guys was so infectious. I don't know of anybody who didn't sign. Most of the wrestlers wouldn't sign stuff if they knew it was going on eBay. You almost had to trick them. But they knew this was going on eBay. And everybody from Hulk Hogan to Randy Savage to Eric Bischoff, to every major name in professional wrestling on both companies, would sign for Jackie because Jackie was a good guy. He became friends with Chris Kanyon. He became good friends with Disco Inferno. He became good friends with Norman Smiley. Had a huge presence on social media, sometimes to his detriment. He took it a little bit too much to heart. God bless him. But I had stayed away from WrestleMania. And I stayed away on purpose because, it wasn't my show to be at. And didn't think that I was a big enough name in people's memories to where they would want me at a WrestleCon type event. About 2.5 years ago, I saw a picture of Jackie at WrestleMania the year before. He was drinking beers with Norman Smiley, Rey Mysterio, Conan, a couple others. And I just happened to comment, that looks like a blast, because those guys are. And we started talking, and I had planned on going to Cauliflower Alley that year. I figured that was more my venue, Cauliflower Alley, than WrestleMania weekend. And Jackie spent weeks not only convincing me to go to WrestleMania that I would have a blast, but he got me booked at WrestleCon. With his help, within 2 weeks, I was booked at WrestleCon. And he helped me come up with a WCW logo microphone that I held when I signed pictures, took pictures with people. I hadn't even talked to him in that long a time. We were just kind of Facebook buddies. But he was there the whole weekend, and I'll be honest with you. I got to go to the Hall of Fame as a guest of Fit Finley's. Did all the same this past year, and none of that would have happened if it wasn't for Jackie. And he was just happy to help. He didn't expect anything. He would say to me, "Could I buy you a drink?" I'd be like, "Sure, but really, I should be because I'll never not let somebody buy me a drink." But what I was thinking was, and I was saying was, I should be buying you a drink. I wouldn't have been here if it wasn't for you. And I'm actually making money and seeing a bunch of old friends going to the Hall of Fame to see Sting and the Freebirds 2 years ago go in. The Freebirds, one of my favorite tag teams of all time. And Sting, I was honored to be there because they used my intro in the packages that led up to his Hall of Fame induction. So I wouldn't have gone to WrestleMania the last 2 years if it wasn't for Jackie, not even close. So I just wanted to take a few moments to pay tribute to a guy who isn't a common name, but everybody who knew him, whether they were a wrestler or whether they were a promoter, or whether they were a fan or whether they were a friend and go on and on and on. Woke up on Monday morning and throughout the day on Monday, and every single one of them were devastated because they don't make people like Jackie Johnson anymore. They just don't. I'm going to be quite honest because I always want to be honest with anybody listening to the show. If this is boring, I promise we're going to get to some good stuff in just a second, and then I apologize, but I felt like I wanted to take 5 minutes and pay tribute to somebody who meant a lot more to this business than I think he thought he did. The one thing I saw on Facebook today is he'd be thrilled if he were still alive, how much everybody was talking about him and posting pictures of him on Facebook and social media, and that's true. He took every time he got together with any group of friends, he took a group picture. We'll never be able to take a group picture anymore, but rest in peace, my friend. You'll be missed. I hope we could come across more like you. And thank you for getting me to go to WrestleMania the last 2 years. I had a blast, and I owe it all to you. So with that, we move forward, and I want to introduce my first guest of a segment I want to call Behind the Spotlight. And we talked about it last week. I want to interview people that, may not be in the WWE Hall of Fame and may not be people that are on your television or people that you see at every autograph session, every WrestleCon, every Legends of the Ring. But people that have a lot, that have put a lot of heart and soul in this business. So Without further ado, I'd like to introduce my first Behind the Spotlight guest, former NWA, WCW, and WWE referee, Nick Patrick. Welcome to Sitting Ringside. Nick, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Dave Benzer. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Looking forward to talking to you. And from the feedback we got on Twitter, when we asked them to send in questions, it looks like a lot of people are interested in hearing what you had to say. So I'm glad you came on, and I appreciate your time. I'm just going to start out, and you know, this isn't about an interview. This is more about a conversation between two old friends. So let's talk. Most people know that your father is the legendary masked assassin, Jody Hamilton. For those who don't know, now they do know, one of my all-time favorite wrestlers and one of my mentors in WCW. He always has a special place in my heart. And one of the best promos in the territorial days of the business by far. But most sons of wrestlers, kids of wrestlers, knew their dad was a wrestler because he was on TV. But I'm curious, because your dad was under a mask, when did you realize he was a wrestler? Did you know, from being very young, or did he not tell you for a while?
Oh, no, I always knew.
Oh, so you always knew.
I always knew since he was a little boy, because he brought us around to the matches every now and then. Because back in the day, in the territory days, we traveled around. So my sister and I was up in pretty much like in middle school. That's when he settled down in Atlanta, because we kept moving around. We'd start making friends, and we'd have to go make new friends. And so he kind of kept us in one place at that point. But we went to the matches with him all the time. So I knew from a little kid.
So let me ask you a question. You'd go to school. Your friends would be talking about how they hated the masked assassin. Did you see what he did to wrestling too the other day? What a horrible person. Were you allowed to tell anybody that he was your dad, or did you have to just kind of pretend you didn't know?
No, I kept it to myself. I kept it secret because back then kayfabe was
sure.
Huge.
Sure.
That's how I was brought up. So I didn't, I didn't mention anything about it. It was easy it was easy sometimes because he was under a mask, but there were so many fans back then that, back in the day, fans would try to follow you from the arena to where you go. And we lived in the territories where we worked back then. So somebody could follow you right to your house if you weren't careful, And there was people that would try to follow my dad that I went to school with. And back in the day, his head would be scuffed up. Well, what happened to him, I told him, I used to tell him that he was a deputy sheriff and he got in a scuffle with somebody.
that's a good cover, because he looks like he could be a deputy sheriff. I'd be afraid.
I'd hate for him to really be one.
From what age did you want to be in the wrestling business?
For as long as I can remember.
As long as you can remember.
Yeah.
And
by
when
the
did
time he started carrying me around, and just for as long as I could remember, I knew that's what I wanted to do in some capacity.
And when did he start training you? How I'm assuming he trained you, throughout your childhood, taught you different things. When did that start, and when did you get serious?
Most of my stuff from my dad actually was not actually working in the ring. Most of the stuff I learned from my dad was psychology stuff.
There was a time that was more important almost.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, from the time I was a little kid, and I wasn't in school in the summer times, I'd ride with him and I'd be in the back seat and just listening to everything him and his buddies had to say. And back then, guys would ride and they would talk about the business the whole time, the matches and angles and what worked and what didn't work and why. I was more interested in that than my schoolwork. If my schoolwork to me was that interesting, I would have absorbed it as much as I did all this other stuff, all the wrestling stuff. I knew that was what I wanted to do.
And so
psychology stuff mainly was from my dad. When I first started getting in the ring and actually working, I was in Georgia Championship Wrestling at the time, and I'd get in the ring with guys like Brad Armstrong and Tim Horner and Buzz Sawyer and Ronnie Garvin. Those are the four guys that I worked out with mostly in the ring.
So they kind of taught you the ways of the wrestling ring, and you picked up the psychology along on the road like most old school wrestlers did. I often wonder now with cell phones and internet and video games and all that, if they tell any of those stories or talk about any of that when they're driving down the road, or if they're too worried about going on social media. But I digress. But those were the good old days. I miss it. You started as a wrestler or a referee?
I started as a referee.
And whose idea was that?
I graduated high school in 79, and I went to college for a year, and it was when I was going to college for that year in 1980. We moved up to St. Joe, Missouri. It was Central States Wrestling. It was owned by Bob Geigel and,
right,
and Pat O'Connor, and Harley Race had a piece of it too, I believe.
I think you're right.
And that's where I got in the ring for the first time ever as a referee, was up in that territory. Fort Dodge, Iowa was my first shot.
Fort Dodge, Iowa.
I went to matches with my dad and had a big blizzard on the way. Half the guys didn't even make it. They pieced together a little show of whatever guys they had there. An old timer named Ronnie Etchison.
I've heard of him.
He was going to referee. And he ended up working. And they said, "Hey, kid, you think you can referee?" And I thought, "Hell yeah." I wanted to work, but I was willing to do anything to get in the ring. And refereeing was cool, too. And so I did it that night. And they said, "All right, you did good." And then they offered me a job of doing it. They filmed their TVs like once a week or once every other week in Kansas City. And I'd go down and work on TV and get maybe one or two extra shots a week out of the deal. And I did that while I was going to college for a year.
That's not a horrible college side job, I got to tell you. I know at some point you ended up wrestling, because I've seen matches with you in Continental recently on YouTube. When did you start to become a wrestler, and what made you go back to refereeing?
I always wanted to wrestle, and toward the end of Georgia Championship Wrestling being owned by Barnett and run by Ole, they had done a deal with me. I signed an angle with Bob Roop, and I started working a little bit. And at the time, Ole sold it to Crockett, and there really wasn't a spot for me as a worker with Crockett. And they had enough referees. I wanted to work anyway. So I went to work for a little local independent lady named Ann Gunkel for about 3 or 4 months until a spot down in Pensacola and Continental opened up. And that's when I went down there. Johnny Rich was working and teamed up with Tommy Rich down there. And something happened. They were out somewhere. And poor Johnny got stabbed and was out. He had to heal up for about 6 or 8 months. And he was in this little gig called the Rat Patrol.
I was going to say the Rat Patrol. I've been watching old tapes on YouTube.
Yeah, I filled in for Johnny Rich in the Rat Patrol while he was out healing up from being stabbed. And when he came back, I moved on and went on to Louisiana and worked for Watts.
And so I'm assuming that WCW called you back, or the NWA called you back and needed a referee? And that's why you stopped wrestling?
Well, I was working for Watts. I was out there for about 6 to 8 months. And 2 weeks before Christmas, I blew my knee out real bad. And I was out of the business for almost 2 years because my knee was completely reconstructed. I blew out every ligament and every tendon. And it took me, surgery back then was way different than now. Like in 85, I got a big old scar down the right side of my knee and another one on the inside, and it took me almost 2 years before I could actually walk right, and even jog without a limp. There was about a year that I walked, my leg was just bent, because after the surgery, they had my leg in a cast. And when they took that cast, and my leg was bent while it was in the cast, and when they took it off, that's where my leg was, and it took forever to get my leg to straighten out, and then to get to where I could actually do anything physical on it. Doctor in 1985 told me I'd never do anything athletic ever again, that I'd be able to maybe jog a little bit and play with my kids, but that'd be the best I could hope for.
Wow.
I got a little more run out of the wrestling business after that anyway.
A little bit of a run. When did you come back? And I'm assuming it was it WCW at the time, or was it still NWA?
Turner had just purchased WCW from Crockett's and just had taken it over. And my dad was already up there for probably about 6 months before I did. And a referee spot had opened up. I don't remember the details of what happened. I think it was maybe Teddy going on and doing something with somebody. I think Teddy was there reffing.
Yeah, and then they made him the manager.
So a spot opened up, and my dad threw my name in there. And I was working for Eagle Snacks at the time, delivering potato chips and peanuts to grocery stores. And I'd gotten my knee bent, you know, working a little bit shots here and there. My dad had Deep South going before all that. And, you know, I worked with him. But when that spot opened up at WCW, and I jumped right on it. I didn't realize what travel was back in the Georgia Championship days. I thought we traveled a lot because we went to West Virginia and Ohio every other week. I had no idea what travel was, going international and coast to coast. And that was an eye-opener.
Yeah, we ran pretty hard. I don't think that I could do it at 51 years old.
That's me too. I got a chance to see the world as the way I look at it. I was given a great opportunity to meet and work with like four or five different generations of all the top guys. You know, I actually had a match with Fez when I was up in Kansas City. I refereed for everybody from Fez to John Cena. I've worked with and all the characters that I've met and places I've been. I got no complaints or no bitterness whatsoever.
So about that time, I started up in WCW, and I was just bringing enhancement talent up, walking around. Junkyard Dog called me Walking Man. I don't know if you remember that. And
that was your nickname, but yeah.
Getting guys for interviews. And
he was the recipient of some serious work. Bless your heart.
Yeah. yeah, you know a thing or two about a couple of those. But Monday Nitro started, and all of a sudden, WCW became a pretty big operation and a pretty big deal. What are your memories of that compared to, you know, just being in the old territory days, and even when Turner first bought it, when we were just playing, you know, getting 1,000 people being happy to get that?
Oh yeah, it was cool to see the difference, because when I first broke in, like I said, I was like still doing territories, and I got hurt, and then when I come back. You know, we had just started traveling, you know, wrestling Georgia Championship Wrestling. That's when cable just started. And the only reason we went up to West Virginia, that was because the Georgia Championship Wrestling show was seen coast to coast, you know, and I don't think they quite had the vision to go coast to coast like Vince did at that time. You know, they were just going, staying within their comfort zone. But, man, what a change from working the Armory and Waycross to Royal Albert Hall in London, and some of the largest venues in the free world. It's amazing. A lot of changes. It's different. There's a lot of changes for the good, like anything. There's good changes and bad changes. I think mainly it was changes for the good as far as for the boys. Back in the old days, you got hurt, you were just hurt. You know, it was like, kid, I appreciate it. You did a hell of a job. Give me a call when you're well.
Sure.
You know, and you was done, you know, and you didn't make a dime, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, you started working for a company that was a corporation, and if you got hurt, they took care of your surgery, and you got paid while you was, you know, while you was off, and I mean, it's huge, huge gains for the boys, you know, and I'm not sure if they knew how big of an impact that was, or if they appreciated it or not. A lot did. A lot of young guys, I don't think, realized how it was before. You know what I mean? You know, the territories was a lot of, it was fun. It was a great time. It was a great learning experience. And they were awesome, fun days. But there was a downside, too. Like I said, you know, a lot of politics, a lot of BS. And, then, you know, that's always going to happen. And that happens with every business. There's lawn care businesses down here that's got BS and politics going.
Yeah, I'm in the real estate business now, and it's even worse than the wrestling business, if you could believe that. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But you are absolutely right. I wanted to bring this up, but I had since I'm going to bring it up anyway, I had a question from Ben Gundrum. asking about the NWO referee angle and how did you become a part of that and what you thought about it. So wanted to give credit to Ben and get into that phase of your career, because a lot of people remember you. Unfortunately, it's, you worked every, 25 nights a week, in small, like you said, small armories and domes and everywhere in between. But it's the big angles that that you're remembered for 25 years later. So how did that come about, and how was it?
I was approached actually by Kevin Sullivan. I'd like to do this heel deal. I think the whole deal that I did was his brainchild. And he's the one that told me a lot of the things he wanted me to do. And I wanted to do it bad. it was a lot of fun. I have to tell you, it generated a ton of response. I have people to this day, I don't look the same, but once they realize who I am, they're like, holy crap, he was that NWO guy. Or they'll say, oh, yeah, I used to hit you in the head with a chair on a video game. like that. But to me, I thought that was cool because, hell, I'm a big enough character for them to use my likeness on video games. I was on several of the WCW games, and then they used my likeness and my voice on the WWE game on 708 and 09. So that's going a long way from taking a shower, standing on the deck on a wooden pallet down in Wake Cross, Georgia.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, we had a question from Jamal Lewis, which actually was a good question. Would you ever worried about that, once the NWO angle ran its course, that you were going to lose your gig, or were you promised, did they have an end game for you afterwards?
No, I was working towards trying to become an agent or something. I knew I had enough talent and enough knowledge to do something, within the industry. And I just went back, actually just slid right back into reffing. And it didn't take long for them to forget all I do. I just didn't do anything questionable. After a while, they just kind of forget about it. They expect you to do something for at first. They expect some shit's going to happen, but after a while, when it doesn't, they just kind of, okay. Then their mind goes on to everything else that they're seeing that it's been barraged at them on the television.
Yeah, sort of like Danny Davis in the WWF. They just kind of made him a referee again, and everybody kind of just accepted it. I don't know if you got a chance to see that back then, because I know you were traveling and down the road. But
I watched some of it. You're right. It was hard to keep up with watching even our own stuff because we traveled so much. You'd get home, you'd only be home for like 2 or 3 days. And that's getting your laundry done and making your reservations for going back on the road again and hitting the road. So.
All right, that was
that for a lot of years.
That was about it. That's what we did, and I enjoyed every moment of it. I got to say,
I got no regrets.
Some way more than others, but so I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you the question that probably is going to haunt you for the rest of your life and career. There was a little pay-per-view that had a little bit of a buildup. I'm obviously being sarcastic. It had about a year buildup, and it was the top WCW pay-per-view of the year, Starrcade. I guess as the story goes, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I wasn't in on all that backstage stuff back then, but I guess as the story goes, you were asked that Sting was going to go over, win the world title over Hulk Hogan. You were asked by Hulk.
Right.
This is the story. I'm not saying what you did. You were asked by Hulk to fast count it to give him an out. And as the story goes, either your fast count wasn't a fast count by any standards, or somebody else got to you and convinced you not to do the fast count. Now tell me, is that story correct? Is it incorrect? Tell me your version.
That's incorrect. What happened is the two people, Sting and Hulk, were the two franchise guys. And these
sure.
two franchise guys were butting heads at the point in time over what was going to happen.
Sure.
And one guy came up to me and told me to fast count it because I was already doing, you know, to get some heat so he'd give him an out.
Right.
And the other guy says, don't fast count it. Just keep it nice and slow. And so the person that was in charge evidently didn't want to make a call, didn't want to pick a side, and made themselves scarce all night long where I could not find them to ask them, hey, what do you want me to do?
So just so we're clear here, the office knew that one side wanted you to count fast and the other side didn't want you to, and knew that you would come for an answer, and sort of kind of ran away from you.
Absolutely.
For the entire day. So you can't find anybody. I'm sure this is going, what are you thinking in your head, Nick? You're not a guy that worries a lot. I know you. You're a pretty confident guy, but you know, what are you thinking at this point? Because like you said, it's the two biggest names in our business, in our company.
I really didn't know what to do. I kept looking for a person in charge right up until time to go out there. And in my mind, I thought, well, I'm going to split the difference and not really fast count. Because back in the day, I gave a nice slow count. One, two, three, when I made my count, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And at the time, WWE had their refs wrapping off that count like their ass was on fire. Number one, two, three, you know, it's done, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, how can you cheat with – I wasn't counting no faster when I was cheating than those guys, you know what I'm saying? So, I just did it differently than I normally do. I didn't do my 1-2-3 NWO heel ref count, but right. I didn't do my normal 1-2-3, like, 1 second count in between, you know, back in the old days. Because it kind of added a little more drama, you know, I thought, you know, at the time, because, you know, business was changing. It was becoming more spotty, you know.
So you kind of split it down the middle for what both guys wanted.
Yeah, I just split it down the middle and didn't nobody get what they wanted.
And so what happens after the match? Any of the party say anything to you? Worried about?
Nobody worried to me.
Really? To this day, you've never really talked to had a conversation with any of the parties involved about why didn't you count fast or why didn't you count slow?
No. Nobody said a damn word to me.
That's amazing because the entire wrestling world and fans were dying to know the big after story. And
they made more of it than it actually was. You know, but if they would have seen the stress level that I had, man, I began to ask, "Hey, what do you want me to do?" Oh my God! I was like, "All right, this is like you said, it was the biggest pay per view of the year." You know, with the two biggest names in the friggin' industry at the time. And it was a pretty heavy spot. But like I said, I just split the difference and then nobody get what they wanted. And the announcers was expecting a fast count. So when they didn't get that, they were like, I don't know what that was. You know, they didn't quite, they kind of caught them by surprise too. They didn't know what to think of it, you know. So yeah, that was an experience. You know, I was wondering. So I thought, okay, well, somebody might give me my walking papers here after this is done. But it never happened. Nobody said from either side or from the office or anything. Said a word. I think they were just glad that it was over.
Yeah, exactly.
They booked themselves into a corner and were glad that it was over.
They didn't have to hide from the referee anymore. It's funny, you know, because if you compare to current events, not to get political, but, you know, it's funny how a lot of people say how much a media creation, you know, the media could come up and make a story so much bigger than it really is. And you know, I went on social media and I said, if you have any questions for Nick Patrick, and, you know, almost every question, you know, was a ton of them had to do with the answer to that question. And
It's
just so funny how
I've been asked that a bunch of different times. Yeah, well, that's the real what happened that night.
And is this the first time you're telling the true version?
Yes, it is.
Did I get the exclusive?
Yeah, because I had to be politically correct because I was working for somebody every other time. You know?
Now you just don't care anymore.
No, I just don't give a dang anymore, man. I let it fly.
Sometimes that's not a bad thing. So
it's a great thing.
WCW moves on, and we lived through this together. You know, starts having some issues. That was an understatement. Yeah. I'm curious, when did you sort of sense the end was near?
Well, they lied to us all the way up to the night before we went down there to do TV because the rumors were out that they were going to sell. And
to Eric,
we kept asking, you know, hey, what's going on, you know? And we were told the night before, I forgot who, it was somebody from the office, before we went down there, because a bunch of us asked, hey, what's going on? And, it's all vicious rumor. We are not selling. And we showed up down there, and then there was Jerry Briscoe, and was it Bruce Pritchard with him? I forgot who all was there. They had the
Bruce Pritchard, Jerry Briscoe, and Shane.
Was there,
and Shane.
Yeah. And then I realized, okay, I guess now it's time to find out if who's going to make the transition.
So in that vein, when did you find out that, when did WWE contact you? How far after, long after that Nitro?
I talked to Jerry Briscoe that night, and I think JR was there, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Wasn't he there, too?
I don't believe so. I know
I spoke to JR when it had to be.
Yeah, he met with everybody in, like, 15-minute intervals in a big hotel in Buckhead.
Yeah, that's when I spoke to him.
Right.
But anyway, I spoke to Jerry Briscoe that night, and so I was interested in making the move, you know, and what he thought. He said, they like your work. You got a good chance. He said, they're going to be doing interviewing everybody. And that's when they told everybody they have a chance. And then they told me to wait for the interview. So I waited and I did the interview. And I talked to JR at the time. And he told me I was on and told me how much money and stuff. And it was way less than what WCW was doing. Especially since I had made my way up to being an agent at WCW at that point. So I really took it back. But that's when I knew. But I was very fortunate because from being an agent, it made me an employee. So I got severance pay when they let us stay off. So they made us take so much time off before they hired their first handful, the first wave of WCW guys that they brought in. They brought Booker T and Dallas, one or two guys in right away.
Right.
Before they brought the first wave of WCW guys in, which was when they brought me in. It was probably about 6 months. And I was very fortunate because I had severance pay coming from WCW.
I was able to get severance.
It was 2 weeks later my first WWE check showed up. So I was very, very fortunate that I really didn't miss a beat there.
Yeah, I was just telling somebody, I did somebody else's podcast last night, and I was telling them that ended up in the XWF, short-lived XWF. The last check of my severance came, and then 2 weeks later, I got my first check, you know, for the XWF. So, I mean, it was, you know, talk about bridging it together. It was barely there.
Yeah, but you and I were in the same boat then. I was very, very, very lucky. Because there was a lot of crew people that, you know, that just got washed. Their bookings just got washed out. You know,
yeah, a lot of people just started getting paid
yourself because they got to try and get into something else other than wrestling. You know, and there's other people doing football and basketball and racing. Because my son's in that gig now, so you know, it's hard if all your bookings just suddenly you're booked up for 6 to 8 months and then all of a sudden, bam, that's gone. Or you're booked up for a year, and all of a sudden, bam, that's gone. You know, you're scrambling now.
Yeah, absolutely.
You guys really took a bullet.
You go up to WWE, and other than the pay cut, how was it different? Tell me about the differences. How is it better? How is it worse than what you've been doing in NWA and WCW?
It was better. It was more organized, and there was one direct person. If you thought you were getting run around, you could go to one person and get the definitive answer. There was one chief. There wasn't like 30 chiefs. You know, and there toward the end of WCW, they had a bunch of chiefs and no Indians. Everybody, you know, who was the boss? Who's not the boss? You know, and they would ship people and it would just become unorganized. Up there, there's always one definitive person that you can go ask. So that was good. The camaraderie amongst the boys up there is very good.
It is very good.
Transition, because when we first went up there, they kind of wanted to bust everybody's balls. It was from WCW.
I was going to ask you how that was. The talent and the referees give you a hard time for a little bit.
The ones that thought they could, they did a little bit. They'd mess with you. They'd have you do goofy shit, you know, and laugh, ha, 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 you know. It's no big deal. But it wasn't like, you know, there were certain people, if they'd started, you know, if you know me, Dave, I'm not going to take a whole lot of crap, you know.
No.
And, there was one or two people that that come with that attitude, and I let them know, hey, look, I've never shown you any disrespect, and you better not ever do that to me ever again. And never had a problem with them, you know.
Yeah, it seems like there's certain people, if you tell them, if you tell them that, they just back off, and if you let them keep
they know you're not their little whipping boy, and that generally they're looking for somebody that they can bully, and if they know that they can't bully you, then they're going to leave you the hell alone.
So answer me an honest question, Nick. I know that you don't put, you just said you don't put up with a lot of stuff like that, and I know you absolutely don't. Say that there was a certain person who was every single night in a different city, they were locking your briefcase to something different in every town, and you had to get bolt cutters to get out of the building to get your briefcase. Would you put up with that?
I would find who did it, and they would find their bag chained to something.
For those who have no idea what we're talking about, I was the victim of quite a bit of my briefcase being locked to different and various sundry.
That ended up being a hell of a group effort. Because it was great for morale, for locker room morale. It started off as one guy, and you kind of knew who it was, and you started watching him. You couldn't get to it, so he drafted me into it. And then him and I started doing it. Then you got where you knew who, you figured out who his culprit was, and so we had to have lookout guys. It was an elaborate ruse, man. I'm telling you. There was people involved that there was always somebody involved.
I'm actually honored that anybody cared enough to, now that I hear that, that's actually a compliment.
Oh, no, anybody, we didn't mess with it because we didn't like you. We messed with it because we did, man.
I know. It's funny, though, because, you know, sometimes I wouldn't be able to get bolt cutters to get the actual combination lock off. So I'd go through an airport. I'd go through an airport with like three or four locks on the handle of my briefcase, and you couldn't even do that anymore. I mean, they wouldn't even let me on the plane. But it was always in good fun, and I'm thrilled to death that you guys had an actual like booking committee and production team were behind.
Oh man, I'm telling you, it ended up being. SWAT team that was.
I thought it was you and Kurt Hennig the whole time. So,
oh, it was, but we had to, once you figured out that it was us, we had to draft help. We had lookout guys. We had everything. It became a group effort.
To dot the I on this story, if you're listening, it got so bad that the ring crew had to start traveling with bolt cutters because. You know, there were sometimes that the janitor in the building wouldn't have bolt cutters. So it was certainly an experience. I look back with fondness and, you know, that was just that, you know, I try to tell people that's how we killed time. You know, you said it was great for morale. You know, you're just trying, we didn't have social media and the internet and cell phones. We were just trying to kill time, telling stories and ribbing people. Like I said earlier, I almost feel sorry that people don't get to experience that anymore in the business as much.
Yeah.
So you're in WWE, the camaraderie's better, the pay's not. I don't remember how long you lasted there, but I'm assuming you worked at least one WrestleMania, correct?
I was there from 2000. They hired me in 2000, but I didn't actually do a WrestleMania until 2001. My first WrestleMania was in Toronto, and I did all of them up until I hurt my back, and I did like six of them, I think. Six or so. I did six, I think.
As somebody who grew up in the business and grew up around the business, your dad was one of the top heels in every territory he worked, if not the top heel. You pretty much did it all as far as WCW. Was there anything cool about being a part of WrestleMania, or did you just think of it as another booking?
No, it was cool. Because the energy, you know how it is when you work in front of a sold out crowd. You know,
sure.
It wasn't the first sold out crowd I've been in front of, but it was the energy. Cause when I first started going up there, it was a whole week long thing. You know, they had little shows and autograph signings and meet and greets and stuff. I mean, it was a whole week long deal, you know,
yeah, it still is
interaction and, it was huge when I found it all. Then they started cutting back. But after I did my first or second one, and it took so long to get my money, and then my money wasn't different than any other pay-per-view, and I had to be there all week long. then it kind of lost its luster a little bit, you know. But it was still, you know, it's still always, you know, performing in front of a crowd like that. My God, that's a dream, you know. That's what everybody wants to do.
All right, we're almost ready to wrap it up, and I appreciate your time. I appreciate the exclusive on Starrcade.
No problem, man. That's the shoot. Yeah, that's how it went down. You know who was in charge back then.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
They did not want to pick a side in that argument. It doesn't.
I know you didn't fill in every single blank name wise, but it doesn't take but about 5 minutes on the internet to fill in the blanks. I had a couple more questions I wanted to ask you. I had Jay Herbert who wanted to know about what you hear from the back. There's a little thing called an IFB that you put in your ear and people could talk to you. And so I had a question as a referee. I talked to Justin Roberts about this in my debut podcast last week about as a ring announcer, what you hear in the IFB, but what was your experience and was it any different in WWE from WCW?
No, it was the same actually. And you can hear the director if he wants to. And you usually hear the agent for the match that you are doing. They can have direct contact with you so that they can send messages to the guys, you know, if something gets off track or, you know, if times, you know, so they just whatever, because they sit and talk all day about the match. So they have the agent for that match on the other end, just talking to us. And the guy that keeps time for the show, letting us know time. So we hear about three different people, you know, we just got to filter out the gaga and listen to, you know, to what's pertinent and follow the match. It's kind of distracting sometimes on live TV.
Do you ever have anybody change the finish in the middle of the match in your ear?
Oh yeah.
So
it happened several times.
Really? And did it throw you off at all? I mean, you had been doing this forever, so I can't imagine. But still,
the hardest part was if it was done on TV. The hardest part was conveying the message without being picked up on.
Right, letting the guys know. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, because when you're working TV, you try and send your message just a little quick, one or two word deals, you know, so that they know what you're talking about. You get in close, you check the book, you get a little one, two words. I know time-wise where you're at or, you know, whatever message is being sent, you know. You don't want to sit there and carry on a five-minute conversation, you know. You a little quick boop, 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 and get the hell out of there, you know.
Absolutely.
That's what you're hearing. You're hearing the director, you're hearing the agent, and you're hearing the guy that's keeping time for the show. It's three different things you're hearing.
I actually just thought you heard the agent and the producer, so I didn't know there was a third person. So, see, I even learned something new. I had a question from @mtorfan01, and I don't remember this. So if this was not you, I apologize. But he asked, how ridiculous did you feel wearing that helmet cam, the ref eye cam? Is that you?
Wow, the referee. That was terrible.
Referee.
It was a big bicycle helmet that had a camera on it. And I did Abdullah the Butcher and somebody. They ended up electrocuting Abdullah the Butcher in it. But I looked like a giant human Q-tip with that thing on my head.
That was only a one-time deal?
Yeah, because it made me look so funny. You know, but the helmet itself wasn't comfortable. You know, it was the battery pack that I had to carry because it had a big old battery pack. And there wasn't nowhere to carry it but in my back pocket. And with that big battery back there, there was no way for me to take a bump or do anything, you know. So it limited what I could do. Terribly, but it was a historical moment in wrestling. They got a different shot out of it, I guess.
This was in WCW, correct?
Yeah, that was in WCW.
I don't know why I don't remember that. Wow. Learn something new every year. Learn another thing. Thanks for MTorFan01 for reminding us about that, because I had no clue. So that was a one and done. And to move on and end your story behind the spotlight as we're doing this segment, know you had a back injury. What year was that? How did it happen? And what are you doing now, if anything?
Well, I was in a car wreck and it formed a spur. And over time, you know, the car wreck herniated a disc You know, you ice it down and you just keep going. You know, and over time, that herniation formed a scar or formed a spur. And I was working up in WWE, and I had to go run and get somebody on deck that wasn't there. You know, they always knew how to get people at the gorilla position.
Sure.
You know, there's always...
It's what I did for your dad when I first...
There's always the guys that you got to drag by their, you know, come on, let's go, you know.
That's what I did for your dad when I first started bringing the guys up in WCW.
So you know what I'm talking about.
Some I know exactly what you're talking about.
And other guys, you're like, come on, dude. You know, don't you? They're playing. They played your music for 5 minutes. Let's go.
And I guarantee you, if we made a list, at least in WCW, we'd have about if five guys. We'd have about four of the same guys on the list. But we're not going to stooge anything off like that. But there are a couple guys who, one guy that. He's famous for a squeegee. I won't say his name, but
great story.
You want to tell it?
No, I wasn't there that night.
Oh, I was, but I'll have to find somebody
yeah,
else.
So you was the eyewitness. I was that happened in Atlanta. I lived
yeah.
in Atlanta, so I didn't do a whole lot of going out to the club afterwards because I was on the road so much, you know. Every now and then, I'd stop in and have a beer, you know, after when we did an Atlanta show, I'd have a beer or two, but it cut into my home time too much.
Yeah, the dungeon. It was interesting place. You could write books about what happened in the dungeon, but then you'd lose all your friends.
Well, the truth, nobody really believed me.
Yeah, exactly. But so anyway, you're running to get a guy, and I'm assuming you fell or
yeah,
something.
I was running to get a guy, and you know where they run the cables all around the back? And they
sure.
ramps over them so that they can run the carts over them. I stepped on one of those in full stride, and that damn spur broke loose. And I felt at the time something happened, and I didn't know. And I was like, oh, shit. So I worked, and I went home, and I flew home the next night. I went to sleep that night, and the next morning I got up, I couldn't get out of bed. And I tried everything. I ended up having to have surgery. And what had happened is that spur had broke loose, and it ended up lodging, and it was sticking into my sciatic nerve. And before my surgery, man, I was all hunched over, and my left leg was turned to the outside, and I was in really, really bad shape, man. So I ended up having to have that back surgery, and I went through all the physical therapy and everything to get started back to work, and I got my first booking to start back to work at the pay-per-view in Las Vegas, Nevada. I'm in the airport in my car, driving to the airport to go to my first shot back, and I'm at the stoplight, and bam! I get rear-ended again, man.
No way. I didn't know that
part. Yeah. Right where that scar was, where I got cut, it felt like an electrical circuit. It went whoop right down my leg, and my foot went to sleep, and my foot has been asleep ever since. And that was basically the end of it. I went and I tried working, and my back kept bothering me, and I couldn't do it. So that was my last shot.
Wow, I didn't know that part of the story. What a brutal ending.
I've done some independent stuff here, you know, within the last few years. But, I tell you what, going on the road and doing a tour would really be, I don't think I could do it anymore. I'm almost positive I couldn't.
The travel or the reffing or both?
I think the travel would get me more than anything because I can't be with my back. I can't be in one position for too long. If I was sitting in an airplane for 6-8 hours, like we used to have to do, man, I'd probably need help off of there. I'd have to get up and walk around the plane every 30, 40 minutes.
Yeah. Well, that's a shame, but you certainly had a great career. And, you know, we could probably sit here and tell stories for decades. Maybe we'll have you on again and we'll just go back and forth telling stories. And I'd love to have you back. But, I'd be remiss. We had a whole bunch of people on social media wanted me to ask you how your dad is. I saw your dad about a month ago, you and your dad. But for the fan, he seems to be doing great. For the fans out there, let everybody know how the legendary assassin is doing.
The legendary assassin is doing great. He's chilling. He's got his pool open for the summer.
There you go.
Him and my mom are just kicking back. He's got a big metal building on his property with a ring set up, and I train a couple of kids in there, and he goes and he pulls his, we open up the big doors, and he pulls his truck up there and sits there and watches and smokes his cigar and critiques the training. So you can see him doing that, can't
yeah,
you?
I could absolutely see him doing that. That's
he cracks me up. He'll have me come over and do something for him, right? I'll be out there working in his yard. And bless his heart, because I know his knee hurts real bad, but Pop isn't going to even walk to the shed in his yard. He's going to get in his truck and drive to it, right? So I'll be out there doing some yard work for him, and he'll want to come out there and sit and watch. And he'll pull his truck up and sit there and park and be sitting in the AC, smoking that cigar, watching you sweat and work. It's like Cool Hand Luke. I want to look up and say, "Hey, boss, can I get some water?"
I could definitely see that without a doubt. And your parent, really great story. Your parents have been married almost 60 years, correct?
Oh, yeah. They're one of the few marriages that survived the wrestling business.
That's amazing. How many years has it been?
Well, I'm 56. I've been married for 57 years.
Wow, unbelievable. It's going to be 60 years. And I've met your mom a few times, wonderful lady. And like I said in the open, I don't think I could have – I don't think that without your dad telling me some things he told me and giving me an opportunity to do what I did to get my foot in the door, I there's no doubt in my mind that we wouldn't be having this conversation. I'd be the one listening to somebody like this have a conversation. So always a special place in my heart. So we thank you for our first Behind the Spotlight guest, and thanks for giving me the exclusive on the big Starrcade story. And now every other podcast will call you to tell it again. So get ready for the barrage of requests.
Hi, man. It's great talking to you, Dave. Thanks.
Once again, a huge thank you for Nick Patrick, our first guest Behind the Spotlight. And we hope to have many more and hope you enjoy it. Most of the times I've been asked to do podcasts in the past, or people ask me questions about the wrestling business, it's almost always exclusively about a story in WCW, because the Monday Night Wars, as we all know, in the history of WCW and the end of WCW, is a big story in the lives of so many professional wrestling fans. A lot of people grew up on it or lived through it like I did, but I kind of got to see a different perspective. So what we're going to try to do every week or so is we're going to have our associate producer, Mike Freeland, come up with a question about WCW. He's not going to tell me what that question is. And I am going to just off the top of my head, tell you guys and tell Mike what I remember about that, what I thought about it, what I didn't like about it or loved about it. And we'll see how that goes. And if you want to chime in down the road, you could shoot your questions to @PenzerRingside on Twitter, @PenzerRingside. Mike will get all of your questions there, and happy to answer anybody's questions, no matter how obscure they are, to the best of my ability. Got to remember, I'm getting older, so the memory is not there as much as it used to be, but we'll give it a try. So without further ado, let's try a WCW flashback. Mike Freeland, welcome to City and Ringside. How are you today?
David, I am doing great. I'm excited to be here on your podcast, and I heard the first episode and I loved it.
Well, quite frankly, if I'm being totally honest, there wouldn't be a podcast if it wasn't for you. Fans, but probably, of course they don't know this, but you're the one who reached out to me after hearing me on as a guest on some podcasts and thought there was something there, and we did. So you did a lot of the digging, and we found radioinfluence.com. So here we are on a podcast, and people are actually listening to it, and I'm grateful. And hopefully we could build a little something. But I want to thank Mike. He's our associate producer. And I know you're a big wrestling fan. So hit me up with a WCW flashback, Mike.
All right. Let's take you back. And because this podcast is just starting off, let's kind of go back to the infancy of the Monday Night Wars. So, David, I guess my very first question to you is, tell me a little bit about the very first Monday Nitro. What was the feeling like when you first heard about the concept, what your involvement was going to be, what the style of the show was going to be, and was there any nerves going into it, knowing that you guys would be going up against the WWE?
Well, yeah, we were touring, you know, on the weekends. We were doing our shows, and we were doing our Saturday night tapings at Center Stage, and word started to get around through the locker room that we were going to go head-to-head live against Monday Night Raw. And I think that everybody's emotions ran the gamut from terrified to what the hell are you talking about, to excited to what the hell are you talking about. And there was a lot more what the hell are you talking about than anything else. You know, hindsight being what it was, it worked, obviously, we know, in a big way. But I don't even think Eric was sold that it was going to work. He sort of, as the story goes, and most fans know who are interested, he sort of threw it out there when he was sitting in Ted Turner's office and Ted asked him, what do you need to be competitive? And he said, I need to go live head-to-head with Monday Night Raw. Thinking that never in his wildest dreams was Ted Turner going to say, okay, put him on TNT for 2 hours every Monday live. So the word started to get out to the boys. And like I said, you know, there was a lot of, you know, we were all excited about the opportunity to do this. But I think that everybody had a little bit of trepidation as to getting our, you know, what's kicked. And then you don't know what goes from here. You know, whenever you try something like that, and if it doesn't work, and you never know if somebody's going to sour on the company or what's going to happen. So, you know, we just kind of ran with the punches. You know, we had Bill Watts and as the booker, and then Bill Watts went away, and we had Ole Anderson, and we had Dusty Rhodes, and we were used to change. They're always trying to find something that stuck, and we're, you know, searching pretty hard back in the early mid 1990s, and so this was, you know, Eric was in charge now. You know, I think everybody was surprised by that. I think probably Eric would say he was surprised that he got the job, but he got the job and he did a lot of innovative things. And then all of a sudden we're going live from the Mall of the Americas at all places. So you're telling me we're going head to head with Raw in prime time live, and we're going to do it from a mall. So it was a pretty interesting concept. He threw on Steve McMichael, who really came out of nowhere and ended up, you know, actually kind of catching on in the business. So him and McMichael and his dog and Bobby Heenan, and away we went, the Mall of the America. I was curious to see if they would try, if I'm being honest, if they would try to bring back Gary Capetta. I was new to being the main ring announcer. They still had Buffer doing the main events of the pay-per-view for the most part. So I'd be lying if I said it didn't go through my mind, you know, with such a high-end opportunity. Are you going to try to bring back Gary? And that was a little scary, you know, because you hate to take a step back. But they trusted me to do the job, and I was honored to have an opportunity to do it. As far as the day of the show, it was kind of hectic considering we were in a mall, and the setup was, you know, was not the most conducive to professional wrestling. But by the time we kicked things off, the fans there were excited. You know, they had some real good matches. They had Jushin Liger against Brian Pillman. Had a heck of a match. They had Ric Flair and help me out with this one.
No, they had Hulk Hogan and the guy who played Big Boss Man. He was
and Ray Traylor. Yeah.
Yes.
So and they had Rick against somebody. Rick against Sting.
I believe it was.
Yeah. So you know, they went all in certainly, and we knew they were going all in, and nobody knew what to expect, and it was it went smooth, quite frankly. You know, there was no emergencies. There was no, you know, last minute hiccups as far as I knew of. The fans were receptive, and we were just doing live television. We had done it, you know, on pay-per-view. So it wasn't like we had never been live. But I'll tell you what, I'll tell you when I knew that they had something going on is when Lex Luger came out at the end of the main event with Doug Dillinger and probably Doug Dillinger, Sting, and Eric Bischoff in hindsight had any clue that he was going to be there. You know, back then they weren't fooling the boys. They didn't work the boys. Most of what they did was on the spreadsheet, was on the script, so to speak. When he walked out, considering he had just worked the night before for WWF and was on their pre-taped television, that was the last. If you'd asked me, you know, what are the chances of that happening, I would have laughed at you. But there he was. And that showed me that they weren't screwing around, that Eric was in this to win this. And if he had to play dirty, and if he had to read off the results of the pre-taped show, if he had to take their talent when they were available to come, that he was out to win. And I think everybody really stimulated everybody, you know, to the fact that we could actually make this work. If Eric and the office is willing to do stuff like this, and Turner and TBS are willing to, and TNT are willing to stick with us for a while, that this is something that may be able to happen. So everybody was excited when it was over. Everybody thought the show went good. The matches were good. You know, that the Luger angle was fantastic. You know, you know now almost every other week there's somebody that walks through the curtain that you don't expect. It sort of become the norm, but back then that didn't happen. Everybody just went back to the hotel in Minneapolis, had a few drinks, and said a prayer that the ratings were going to be okay. I don't know that anybody had any idea of what we were going to get. I think Saturday night was maybe averaging around a 1.6 to a 1.8 rating. Raw at the time, especially when it was pre-tape, was averaging about a 3.0 to a 3.1 rating. So we were all nervous, I'm sure none more than Eric. And then the next day, we got the rating back, and I believe it was a 2.6, and they got a 2.8. So it was a 0.02 difference in who watched them and who watched us. And if I remember correctly, that was like the best of case scenario in the world. Like Eric, Sunday before the first Monday night show, Eric would have said, if you could get a 2.6 and they get a 2.8, how happy would you be on a scale of 1 to 1,000,000? And Eric probably would have said 1,000,001. I don't want to put words in his mouth. Maybe we could have him on here sometime and ask him. But I think, you know, I think he would have taken that in a heartbeat. I don't think anybody expected to win, and we came damn close. So we were off and running, and we knew we had something. And Eric, you know, kept bringing more people in. We brought luchadors in. We brought Sabu came in on the next show, I believe, from Miami. I think it was at the James L. Knight Center was the second one. And as we know, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, the NWO, and Monday Night Wars was off and running. But I'm not quite sure if anybody in WCW, being honest, would say that they had any great faith that the Monday Night Wars would be anything like they were when the first Nitro was announced. So it's an interesting topic to go back and talk about and think about. But I appreciate the fact that they had enough trust in me to let me to anchor the crowd. And, you know, we just went from there. We were excited. And just, you know, the next thing you know, they gave us an extra hour, and then they gave us Thunder. And all of a sudden, you know, what went from an easy, pretty easy schedule became a pretty crazy schedule for everybody involved. But nobody had time to complain. We just did our jobs and went to the next city or went home for a couple of days.
I know definitely something I've thought about, and I know probably a lot of other people have. And once again, when you're in the moment, you don't really think about it a whole lot. But you've been announcing in arenas. What was that like as far as the dynamics, as far as production was concerned, as far as fans, where you're going to put them when it came to an event like the very first Nitro in the Mall of America? Because, I mean, as you watch the DVDs that have been since released, you know, you see the escalators going up and down. You see the fans. You see the different restaurants and stores. What was that like? Was that kind of a chaotic type of situation, or did WCW handle that pretty well?
I wouldn't describe it as chaotic, but I would describe it as pretty strange. We, you know, yeah, as you said, there's people going up and down elevators watching wrestling on live television, and you know, watching from three levels up and watching from the pretzel place, the workers at the pretzel place and the pizza parlor and the Slurpee stand were all watching. And it wasn't your normal wrestling crowd. There were a lot of fans there, but there are also a lot of people that just kind of watching because they were there and wanted to see a spectacle, and a spectacle it was. But I'd be lying if I said it wasn't strange. But when you do something like that, like we did with, Road Wild and in Sturgis, and like we did when we did, you know, the spring break shows, you kind of just went with it, hope the fans enjoyed themselves and hope they reacted the right way. And as far as that went, everybody cheered when we wanted, you know, wanted them to cheer, and booed when we wanted them to boo, and got into the matches. And so as far as that goes, it was no different from a normal wrestling show, but the setup was definitely one for the ages, so to speak. And I don't know what was behind Eric's thought process of doing it at Mall of the America, other than the fact that, to be honest, we weren't drawing very good at arenas. So I think he wanted a spectacle. And if you draw at the Mall of the America and, you know, you tell people that you got free wrestling with Hulk Hogan and Sting and Ric Flair and all these guys, then people are going to come out and take a look, see what you got to offer.
Yeah, I was just going to say that actually sounded like a really good marketing standpoint as far as, like you said before, if you're not getting a lot of fans coming in, why not go to a place where the fans are already at? You know what I mean?
Sure, sure. And like I said, I think the second Nitro was at the James L. Knight Center. And that I'm familiar with that building because I lived in South Florida for so many years. And that building is small. It only holds about 3,000-4,000 people tops. And it's a one-sided building. So it's not like a building in the round. There's a stage and then there's the audience. It's sort of like an amphitheater. But a small one. So, you know, we didn't have to draw a big house to make that look good. And I can't remember where we went from there, but we started out doing pretty small buildings. And eventually, we know the story, it exploded and we were selling out domes in 24 hours. So well, it's got crazy, but that's information and discussion for a different WCW flashback.
It's so funny you had mentioned earlier when Lex Luger came out, because on a DVD that was released, Eric had said that Sting had actually come up to him and asked him to bring him back because Lex was, you know, allegedly unhappy with the direction he was going in WWE. And, you know, Eric threw out a really low ball figure thinking that Lex wouldn't take it, but Lex did take it. So I guess, was it kind of a surprise to everybody that Lex did come back, especially after he was having his success with his match with Yokozuna with SummerSlam, that all of a sudden he's here? Was there any kind of like, what's going on or what happened here, or how did Eric pull this off?
Yeah, I think everybody was shocked because he, like I said, he had worked the night before. I think they had him at the time teaming with the British Bulldog, and he had worked the night before in Canada somewhere, obscure. And was on the taped Raw that was scheduled to air. So the last thing, you know, the last thing anybody thought of, you know, like I said, now we're almost programmed to think that somebody, you know, to look to the back and see who's going to run out. It wasn't like that then. You know, you might have a run in, you know, of people that were, you know, on the card, you know, like, you know, a pull apart or something like that. But you didn't expect a guy who was on, who worked for the other company and everybody thought was under contract to, right, to just, you know, I think everybody, including the wrestlers and myself and the fans and the pundits, I think were saying, how are we allowed to do this? You know, isn't he under contract? And, you know, we're going to get, you know, not that, you know, where, you know, I had personally any control over if we were going to get in trouble or anything. But I think that was the thought process. Like, why is Lex Luger here? And, you know, and what does it mean? Is he here for one night? Is he here for, you know, and is he allowed to be here? And is he under, you know, there were so many questions, and that was the hook. I mean, it was a brilliant hook.
Absolutely.
Had just gotten a pretty decent push in WWE, although they were tapering that down. And he was much more well-known to the fans of WCW and the NWA as being a former horseman, former champion. So it almost meant more going from WWE back to WCW than it would have if it was the opposite as a surprise. But, you know, I often wonder... You know, you're Vince McMahon, and you really, you know, you're kicking WCW's butt. And, I mean, it's not even close. And, you know, you hear that Ted Turner's putting up the money to do a live show opposite your show. So you're going, all right, nah, I got to deal with something. It's probably not going to work for them, but, you know, I got to deal with it. And we're going to have to figure out ways to, you know, get more creative and stuff. So I often wonder what his reaction was. It'd be priceless if they had like a video, what his reaction was. And, I believe only he knows that, when he found out that Lex Luger, who he thought was his, walked out on the first episode of WCW Monday Nitro. I guarantee you he wasn't happy. I guarantee you that a light bulb went off in his head and I guarantee you he thought, this may be harder than I thought it was going to be. And, you know, certainly don't want to, you know, put thoughts into Vince McMahon's mind of all people. But, you know, that was some of the things that we were all wondering. You know, we didn't know. And there was no internet back then. So, you know, we didn't know if he was under contract. We didn't know how that happened. We, you know, there was dirt sheets, but you had to wait until you know, you have to wait a few days for the dirt sheet to come to your, not to say that I ordered it, but if I did, I had to wait a few days or a week to have it come in the mail. So then if you were traveling, you had to wait till you get home. Not that I had it, but, looking back, if you look at moments in this business that have turned, the tide in one way or another, I absolutely put Lex Luger walking out on the first Monday Night Show as one of the top 10 moments that I can think of, that really turned the tide in, the world of professional wrestling. And, to be able to be there live and to live through it and be able to reminisce about it is super cool as well.
So let me ask you this. When it comes to surprises, big reveals, was that something that Eric kind of like kept pretty close to the chest? He didn't really let a lot of people know. Were you privy that this was going to occur at what time? Or were you kind of like, oh, wow, I had no idea this was going to happen, and kind of living in the moment?
Nobody knew, and he didn't tell hardly anybody. He told the people that had to know. As the reveal after reveal after reveal after reveal, unless it had gotten out in the news like the Scott Hall and Kevin Nash thing, we didn't know. There were some times that you could see a segment was, TBD, so you, after a while you got smart to it and you were like, all right, who's going to walk out now, and take bets in the back. But no, I think Sting and Lex Luger and Doug Dillinger and Eric Bischoff were the four people, maybe the executive producer. I think if I remember correctly, the executive producer was just told to shoot what he was about to see. And, because I think the only thing was that they were afraid that there was something crazy going on and he wasn't going to shoot it because it was, we weren't allowed to shoot it. So I think if I remember correctly, he told the truck, whatever happens at the end of this next segment, shoot it. It's okay. It's good. It's cool.
Wow.
And like I said, not to beat a dead horse, but nobody was used to that. Nobody, if Lex Luger was coming back, you had, weeks and weeks of short segments to promote it, interviews to promote it. So this was something totally different. That's why I say that I'd love to see the look on Vince McMahon's face and the McMahon family, when they realized what had happened. Cause we were in shock. And again, if I'm remembering correctly, I didn't know whether only reason I knew that it was okay is cause Doug Dillinger was standing right there. And if it wasn't cool, Doug would have gotten him out of there. But other than that, right. I had as many questions as the audience did as a fan that was part of the company, probably more. And as we, continue to do flashbacks like this, it's become the norm for sure. But that one shot was the shock of all time. And it was the beginning of a lot of shocks, quite frankly.
Maybe it's just me, but it seems like WCW had conditioned a lot of their fans to, with the limo pulling up and hearing Tony going, something's happening in the back, and then all of a sudden, either a limo or a Hummer or a car pulled up. WCW was the first time I actually remember that happening. Do you remember that being kind of a first when you guys were kind of bringing somebody in and it was kind of an unannounced shock? Because I had never previously remember seeing that on a live television show.
Well, one of the hooks of WCW Monday Nitro became, A, it's live always, and it took them a while to catch up to doing it live every week instead of doing one live and one tape. And B, the hooks certainly was, you never know who's going to show up. That was as much the same for the locker room and the office and the referees and myself. You just never knew, we all came to the building going, all right, who do you think showing up tonight? It was almost disappointing if nobody showed up. That's, you get to a spot where you play, can you top this? Obviously, they kept trying to top themselves and eventually brought in Bret Hart and different people. But that was, that was certainly the hook. Who's in the monster truck in the back? Who's in the limo in the back? And a little bit to this day in the world of professional wrestling, they still use that. Any time a limousine pulls up on WWE Monday Night Raw or SmackDown, You know, it's usually somebody who, you know, is going to be a surprise, either somebody who hadn't been there in a while, or Triple H, or Vince, or, you know, somebody that's not a regular character. That's almost become the staple of, uh-oh, we're going to reveal something, so you better stay tuned. But I will tell you what, you know, they did that. You know, I can remember a couple of times watching Georgia Championship Wrestling back in the day in the 80s. You know, they'd have who's in the box, the mystery tag team partner. I can remember Georgia Championship Wrestling one time. Dusty Rhodes had, I think, the Crusher one time in a box. And then one time, I think, Mad Dog Vachon in a box. You know, who's in the box? But, you know, you knew there was a mystery partner. You knew something was coming. So there was always intrigue in wrestling as to, you know, to try to get people to keep watching. But not to this level of not even promoting that there's going to be something big. You know, the general thought process is, hi, this is Eric Bischoff. This is our initial, kickoff Monday Nitro. And you're not going to want to change the channel because you're going to see something that you wouldn't believe. And, you know, you think that that was the way that wrestling was done. And so, to have somebody like Lex come out with no promotion, you know, and just kind of like he was invading a show, that just had never been done before, as far as I knew. And on a national scale, with as much curiosity as Monday Night Show got, just because it was something new, I don't think that there could have been a better hook. You know, it could have been a little bit of a bigger name, but Lex was a pretty big name. And other than that, I don't know that you could have done more. And I think that the audience, I know that the audience knew that you don't miss this show, because they may not tell you or promote to you that something's big going to happen. It might just happen. So you can't miss it. And you have to give Eric Bischoff, or whoever came up with that, as far as I know, is Eric, huge credit. Changed the entire business, as we know, and created the Monday Night Wars. So I appreciate you throwing that out, and hopefully the fans enjoyed it. Let us know. As I had said in last week's podcast, we're going to try some things, and we hope you like them. And if you don't, if you like them, let us know. If you don't, let us know. And hopefully some things will stick, and maybe we'll drop some things or not do them as often. But Mike, I appreciate you jumping in. We'll do this as much as the fans would like to hear stories, and until we run out of stories, I guess. And but I do encourage the fans to write in their own questions. Everything is on the table. Nothing's off limits. So hit on Twitter at Penzer Ringside, and hopefully we'll have more conversations like this, and I really hope the fans enjoy the honest feedback from somebody who lived it.
Dave, I love going down memory lane with you and enjoying this. Thank you for taking us to the first ever Monday Nitro behind the scenes.
So that'll about wrap it up for this week with Sitting Ringside. Hope you enjoyed the show. Nick Patrick, want to thank Mike Freeland as well for WCW Flashback. I'm not kidding. Let us know what you think, positive or negative, good or bad. Appreciate any of the input. Obviously, I'm new at this, so look forward to hearing back. And only thing I can promise is we'll try to put out the very best that we can each and every week, and we hope you enjoy it. So until next week, I'm still sitting ringside. Take care, guys.
Follow David Penzer on Twitter at David Penzer. Also, make sure to follow the show on Twitter at Penzer Ringside. You've been sitting ringside with David Penzer on Radio Influence.
When you are looking for the latest news and notes going on in the world of mixed martial arts, the MMA Report podcast is the place to come. News from the UFC, Bellator, World Series of Fighting, and so much more. And also, we'll have interviews with some of your favorite fighters. The MMA Report podcast can be found on RadioInfluence.com, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and SoundCloud.